from WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection Arts Friday. I'm Bob Smith, and the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra and the Eastman School of Music and the U of R are gathering together to celebrate African Americans in music, as a matter of fact. Next weekend, Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater will host a special program by the RPO, including several signature works evocative of Black History Month and recalling themes that are being set by the Rochester Museum's current exhibit and community dialogue, Race, Are We So Different? Well, the answer, when it comes to the involvement of the African-American community in serious orchestral music, is no. African-Americans share with all Americans a rich heritage in that regard, as we'll find out. The program on the 7th and the 9th will include, for example, a presentation of William Grant Still's 1931 Symphony No. 1, Afro-American, and Eastman School of Music Dean Douglas Lowry's new work inspired by the Underground Railroad, The Freedom Zephyr. Now, Dean Lowry is here in studio together with Dr. Paul Burgett, U of R Vice President, who will provide the narration of the work. And the conductor of the evening's entire program, Rochester area native and now internationally praised maestro Ward Stair, is joining us online as he is on the road going about the world conducting music for audiences all over the world. And gentlemen, I thank you all for being with us today. Welcome to the program. Maybe if we can, a little history might be in order about William Grant Still. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but as I understand it, his work was premiered by the RPO under Howard Hanson back 82 years ago, in 1931. And is it, in fact, the first major symphonic work by an African-American composer performed by a major orchestra in America and premiered by a major orchestra? That's groundbreaking, and we did it right here in Rochester, really.
That's exactly right, Bob. Howard Hanson, of course, was famous for the Institute for American Music and being an advocate for American music that was strongly supported by George Eastman and Rush Reese. In fact, that's why he was brought to the Eastman School as its director in 1924. He himself was a composer, and he established the Institute for American Music, and he held this every summer. Well, Grant Still composed this symphony. It was his first, the Afro-American Symphony, in 1930. And Howard Hanson chose it to be premiered by the RPO in 1931. So it received its premiere. Now, there's an interesting little story that goes along with this, that Dr. Still didn't have the... I have not been able to verify it, but it's a wonderful story. That Dr. Still did not have the train fare to get himself to Rochester. And so Dr. Hanson allegedly provided him with funds for transportation so that he could come to Rochester. They became, if not fast friends, very respectful of one another. And several of Dr. Still's pieces were performed during the summer music festival. And one of his works, a ballet by the name of Saji, S-A-H-J-D-I, Dr. Still dedicated to Dr. Hanson.
And I understand that there is also, I haven't been able to find it, I would have loved to play a little bit of it, but I couldn't find it, a recording that Howard Hanson conducted of the symphony with the RPO 8 years after the premiere in 1939. Is that still out there someplace?
You know, I know about the recording. I don't know whether there are any examples of it extant.
I think it'd be interesting to hear. Of course, let's face it, if you want to hear it, come to Kodak Hall on the 7th and the 9th, and you'll get a chance to hear it the way the RPO does it right now. Ward, you're on the line. You'll be conducting it along with the rest of the program, which we will talk about later. And from your point of view, what's it like as a work to conduct with a full symphony of the quality of the RPO?
Well, it's a wonderful work, for one thing. It's full of beautiful melodies and beautiful textures. The most striking thing when I first started learning the work is the opening of the fourth movement, which is just a gorgeous hymn. It's subtitled Aspiration, and I think William Grant Still was truly inspired when he wrote this work. And I've read in a couple different places that he really set out with a goal to show that, you know, the jazz idiom and the jazz bluesy tradition could be taken seriously in the symphonic form, and I think he was absolutely able to achieve that. And so you'll hear a lot of lines in the orchestra, which at first may sound like jazz, but then still treats them in a very classical manner. But of course, he also uses his own unique voice. So if you haven't ever heard the piece, it's a really, really fascinating work, and I think definitely worth checking out. And of course, this is where it was born, right here in Rochester, which makes it extra special.
Now, of course, when you talk about some of the things that it evokes, what pops into my mind, even though I have not heard the piece myself, I think, that reminds me of the kind of things that people like even Duke Ellington were trying to do in his marriages of symphonic or orchestral approaches and jazz themes, both then and later on. Is there any evidence that the two men were aware of each other and perhaps influencing each other?
I'm not aware of any direct evidence. Dr. Burgett, you might know more about this than I do.
Yeah, they certainly did know each other, absolutely. Uh-huh. And Grant Still, while he was a violinist, but he was also an oboist. And so he was part of the New York City, the East Coast Corps of Musicians. He was also trained. He was educated in ways that Ellington was not. Interestingly enough, Duke Ellington was seen by the black and white intelligentsia of that part of the 20th century as the person to look to translate the American popular jazz and blues idiom into masterpieces of musical art in the same way as symphonies and ballets and that sort of thing.
Well, they got that right.
Well, and he made efforts at doing it, and there's some very important works of Ellington's as a result. But Grant Still composed more precisely in classical idioms of symphonies and et cetera, and I think his training had a great deal to do with that. In fact, Ellington was cautioned away from formal training because he himself said, I would lose the spirit of who I am as a musician if I went to a conservatory to study. Grant Still, on the other hand, went to Wilberforce. He was a student at Wilberforce, and although his parents wanted him to be a physician, his heart was in music, and that's what he studied. And so he had greater experience with classical forms than Ellington did.
And he worked with Berez also, didn't he?
Well,
he was
influenced by Berez. Yeah, but he sort of abandoned some of the more modern idioms. He abandoned. Interestingly enough, Berez, because he was such. Verez was such a revolutionary with the works that he was doing. Both Grant Still and Charlie Parker, the famous bebop artist, Charlie Parker wanted to study with Verez. It didn't happen. But Grant Still did study with Verez for a bit of time, but he abandoned the more modern forms.
Mm-hmm. So he remained in more traditional forms then?
Grant Still remained in more traditional forms that were coincident with the compositional styles that someone like Howard Hanson was embraced and was more familiar with and supported.
I guess they were basically contemporaries too, weren't they?
They were.
They're both, I guess, born in the 1890s, right?
Grant Still was born a little earlier than that, I think. Yeah, I can't remember the exact date of his birth.
So these were men who really were coming of age at a time when music was, well, certainly in an age of transition too. How did Grant Still handle all the transitions that were happening in music at that time? Because it was a time. I mean, you look at the 1930s; it was such a time of ferment.
It was a very difficult world for an African American composer, as you might imagine, in those days, to find someone who would take his work seriously. That's what makes Howard Hanson, in my mind, heroic in some sense, because he was willing to transcend some of the less attractive, some of the unattractive aspects of racial discrimination and give Grant Still an opportunity. Grant Still ended up going to California. In California, he lived in L.A., and in L.A., I think he was able to find a more congenial environment. Maybe Doug would have some view about that.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know if I could speak to that, but the congeniality of the Los Angeles environment. I mean, I certainly lived there for a good 26 years, but it might have been likely that the mixture of influences in Los Angeles at that time, in fact, may have been more to his temperamental liking. And he may have found that, you know, the mix of film music and jazz and popular music and symphonic music in a city that was struggling to gain its identity and certainly keenly interested in becoming a major force in the classical music world, that may, in fact, have really fed his muse.
I wonder, given the dominance of the film world and the film industry out there from the dawn of sound film onward, in music, did he get into film music and film scoring later on after he went out there, like so many of his contemporaries did?
He may have. I'm just not aware of the you know, the bibliography of his music and the potential for that. But certainly, it would have stood to reason.
He did. In fact, he did musical scores for not just films. Pennies from Heaven.
Uh-huh.
He did the score from Pennies from Heaven. He did scores for a number of television shows. So he was able to find not only satisfaction as a composer, but he was able to earn a living,
yeah,
as well.
Which
and
is
a
that's
small
so easy
thing, yeah.
That's so easy to do,
right? And so he had a history with some notable film and television. He may have done a Gunsmoke. He may have done Gunsmoke. He did Pennies from Heaven, and a few other film and TV things. But also it goes all the way back to the earlier part of the century. That would have been in the 50s, or the earlier part of the century, when he was in the orchestra of Noble Sissle and UB Blake Shuffle Along. He was in the pit orchestra as an oboist in the 1921 Broadway show, which took Broadway, as you know, took Broadway by storm. He was in the pit orchestra for that.
Speaking of oboes, what popped into my head, and I don't know if this is an irrelevant thought or not, I know one of the prominent oboists who also made his name in popular music and who also has a real Rochester connection because he came from here.
Let me guess.
Mitch Miller.
Yes, sir.
You know, did their paths cross? Did they know each other and work together at all that we know of?
That's a good question. I do not know. Except to say that Mitch Miller did know Charlie Parker, and Mitch Miller played with Charlie Parker. Some of Charlie Parker's Jazz at the Philharmonic stuff with Norman Granz features Mitch Miller on oboe and Charlie Parker on alto. And so whether Granz still was aware of that or knew him or not, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Serious instrumental music is a small world, isn't it?
It is indeed.
A very small world, yeah.
and it's fascinating to see all this cross-pollination there. But can we take a look? This is something that I'm curious about, too. William Grant Still's influence on later generations of people moving forward, even beyond the film and television scoring area, where obviously he had impact on that, but... did he impact later generations of serious orchestral composers, maybe even all the way to this time? And can we trace the influence?
I don't know if you can trace the influence. I remember as a student sitting in the orchestra playing the works of William Grant Still, and I remember at that stage of my musical evolution, which was very early, being struck by his struggle. Struggle is a too strong of a word. His attempts to fuse music of his background, his upbringing in the classical realm, and I remember thinking that he was easily one of the most successful at doing that. And you could sense the music of his own temperament gliding along very, very comfortably with this classical idiom, and I just remember it being very inspiring. That doesn't help us solve this question of can you trace it, but I do remember feeling that sensation, intuiting that musical combination.
Is this something that a lot of composers, a lot of conductors, a lot of performers try to do, to bring in and try to be eclectic in what they're doing? I kept thinking, I'm reminded of that in the context of conversations I had with Dave Brubeck while he was around and coming to the Jazz Festival, and some of the influences that he had and that he was working into his music. And I was thinking as well of some things that even a lot of rock artists have done in trying to incorporate the classics into their work. Most notably groups like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, but even going beyond that, trying to bring classical influences and themes and refrains into their work as well, and even orchestration. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but everybody seems to feel the need, don't they?
Look, you know, it's very important to point out that in the early part of the late 19th, early 20th century, Antonin Dvorak, who was living in the United States for a brief period of time until his homesickness for Bohemia drove him to return to the Czech community back home. He needed to go back home, but he had he was the president of something called the National Conservatory in Washington, D.C. And one of the students at the National Conservatory was an African American singer, baritone, by the name of Harry Burley. And Burley used to sing Negro spirituals to Dvorak. So Dvorak articulated a vision for American music, uniquely American music, in which he said that much as European nationalists had embraced the raw folk musical ore of their people, the Russians had, the Norwegians had, the Bohemians had, just as they had, the Norwegians had, just as they had, so must American composers embrace the raw folk musical ore, and by that he meant African-American, or in those days, Negro folk musical ore, the blues, the religious music, and incorporate that music into larger musical forms like symphonies and operas. And Harry Thackeray Burley used to sing to him. So that's how Dvorak came to know this music. So the idea, and we're looking at a European composer to exhort American composers to begin to use this music. And I think the rise of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s sort of fueled an ambition to make that happen. And so we have composers like William Levy Dawson. You very rarely hear about William Levy Dawson, who was a contemporary of Grant Still. William Levy Dawson's Negro Symphony is a fabulous work. I absolutely recommend it. The Negro Symphony of Levy Dawson is wonderful. Florence Price, a woman we hardly ever hear of, her symphony is spectacular, as is her piano music. She was a pianist. Margaret Bonds, another one of the same era, who is she was a marvelous conductor. Margaret Bonds was, and a marvelous pianist. Then there's a later generation of black composers who look to Grant Still and Levy Dawson as inspiration and influence. People like Hale Smith, people like T.J. Anderson, people like a contemporary, Adolphus, someone still alive, Adolphus Hailstorm, who has performed here in Rochester, New York, and has connections here in Rochester. I would also say that someone like George Gershwin, many of the names that I've just mentioned, we've not heard of. George Gershwin, we all know about. And George Gershwin was successful in translating what Dvorak had been talking about in support of this raw musical lore.
Which, of course, gets us to Rhapsody in Blue, which is part of the program on the 7th and the 9th, which, Ward, you're going to be conducting. And incidentally, we are talking this hour, this portion of the Arts Friday program at 1370 Connection, with Dean Douglas Lowry of the Eastman School of Music, with Dr. Paul Burgett, Vice President of the University of Rochester and music historian, who's going to provide the narration of the work, The Freedom Zephyr, Dean Lowry's composition, which you're going to be hearing during the program. And we have Ward Stair on the line for this portion of the program. He is the conductor for the program on this coming Thursday and the following Saturday evening at the Eastman Theater's Kodak Hall. Now, this is, of course, when we talk about Rhapsody in Blue, we talk about something that we're all familiar with, at least the opening themes of. It's a pretty subtle work, and it's a very complex work when you hear it in full, and obviously a very rewarding one as well. I'd be curious to know what we should know about it that perhaps we don't know from just having maybe heard it superficially, and what will you bring to it, Ward, as you're conducting it with the RPO?
Well, actually, there are several unique things about the creation of this piece, which I think bear mentioning. For one, there had been this idea to try to write, you know, like a jazz-inspired piece for the classical music arena, and there were producers trying to get Gershwin to do this for a long time, and they were calling. They had this huge concert that they were putting on, and it was called this Great Musical Experiment. But Gershwin was really procrastinating in writing any music for it. And then he saw the ad. The story that I heard is he actually saw an advertisement for this concert in the paper and thought, oh boy, I better start working on this piece. And he was actually on a train on the East Coast when he said the first inspiration hit him. So a lot of the themes in Rhapsody in Blue, you hear sort of a locomotive element. And if you think back to Gershwin sitting on the train, being hit with that moment of inspiration, I think it puts those themes in a slightly different context. The other thing which is interesting to note is that he was finishing it so last minute that in the premiere he actually told the conductor, and this always makes me laugh because imagining being the conductor in this scenario is a little bit scary, because he said, I'm just gonna interpolate this, I'm just gonna improvise a little bit, and I'll nod to you when it's time to bring the orchestra in. So as a result, in the piece, as you sit to listen to it, of course, you recognize all the themes, but notice that there are huge amounts of time. I think the longest is almost 3 minutes, where the piano plays totally alone, and then the orchestra comes in, and the orchestra will play alone. And there's a lot of back and forth. Of course, they do play at the same time as well. So that's an interesting history, I think, of the genesis of the piece. And it was actually an experiment in the very beginning, and it turned out to be one of the most recognizable pieces in the repertoire.
And speaking of the pianist, of course, you've got a star to work with. You've got Grammy nominee Terrence Wilson doing the keyboards. Of course, he is part of a new generation of African American exponents of classical music, and you've conducted him on a number of occasions. What should we expect from him, especially given all the honors he's gotten and all the critical praise he's won?
Well, Terrence, I really enjoy working with Terrence. We worked, actually, the last time we worked together was in St. Louis with the St. Louis Symphony, and we did Gershwin, although we did the Concerto in F, which is another great piece. And Terrence has a great energy in his performance, but he also, you know, he has a way of approaching a piece like Rhapsody in Blue, which we're all so familiar with, and giving it a freshness, which I think is just wonderful. And he's got you know, top-notch training. He's a virtuoso. The technical issues are non-existent, which gives him the freedom to really just emote and be creative, sometimes even in the moment. And that's the kind of performer that I enjoy working with most. And so I'm thrilled to be working with Terrence again in Rochester.
Bob, I would just remind our audience that Terrence Wilson was in Rochester 2 years ago for the Gateway Music Festival, which we hold here every other year, and the Eastman School has been a real supporter of that festival. And Terrence was here and did the Beethoven Third Piano Concerto to great acclaim. I mean, I just want to piggyback on what Ward is saying. This is a young wunderkind. I mean, he's a tour de force that's really worth hearing.
This is a man who's really just getting started and has already accomplished a lot, so we're probably going to be seeing even more and hearing a lot more of him in the future. So catch him while you can, I guess. And this is going to be important. This is an interesting thing. Again, here we are. He is a young man from the African-American community who has really become one of the foremost pianists in the classical realm that we have today. And I guess it's fair to say he's basically another gentleman who shows just exactly why it has this kind of music has no bounds, and it reaches to everybody, and everybody reaches out to it.
Right. Well, he's a phenomenal artist just in general. I mean, anybody that can pull off a work of Mike Daugherty is remarkable. That's a remarkable feat anyway. Michael Daugherty is a very, very gifted, very idiosyncratic composer, but he was nominated for the Grammy for this piano concerto and with the Nashville Symphony, and so This young man is an artist extraordinaire.
So it's going to be a real treat on a number of levels, some of which, of course, we've already talked about, and one of which we will be talking about as well in just a moment, because we happen to have its composer and its voice with us as well. We'll be talking about that very shortly as we continue. I know your time is limited, Ward, but I want to thank Ward Stair for being with us on the line, and we'll look forward to seeing you, Ward, with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra in Kodak Hall on the 7th and the 9th of this month. And I guess also we should mention a week from tonight down in Ithaca, New York.
That's absolutely correct. Yep,
that's right.
Right. So this program will be presented there in between its two performances in Rochester. You're heading down Route 96 to Ithaca to perform it there. Where will it be there? I'm thinking, is it going to be Bailey Hall at Cornell or someplace else? Another venue?
I wish I could answer that. I don't know. I'm waiting for my instructions. Ward, I don't know if you know. Do you?
I can't remember the name of the venue, no, but I'm also waiting for the finalized directions to drive. So,
you know, I find this remarkable. We've got all these people from Rochester who don't know where they're going. All right, yeah.
just hit the hall before.
just follow Route 96 down Ithaca, and you'll get there.
And look for the crowds. We'll get there.
Exactly.
Follow the sound of musicians warming up.
Yeah.
You got it. Our thanks to conductor Ward Stair for being with us on the line, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment on this Arts Friday edition with Eastman School of Music Dean Douglas Lowry, and you have our Vice President and noted music historian, Dr. Paul Burgett. I'm Bob Smith. 1370 Connection will continue in just a moment here on WXXI AM 1370. WXXI Connection continuing on WXXI AM 1370. I'm Bob Smith. It is the Arts Friday program. And I want to remind you, next weekend on the 7th and the 9th, and incidentally also on the 8th if you happen to be down in the Ithaca, New York area in the meantime, the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra will be presenting several signature works evocative of Black History Month and recalling themes even at the Rochester Museum's current exhibit and community dialogue, Race, Are We That Different? Well, of course, the answer is no, as we're finding out, when it comes to the involvement of the African-American community in serious orchestral music, where there is a rich history of participation and a rich heritage dating back over a century and moving forward to the current day. African-Americans do have a rich heritage to share in that regard, as we're finding out. And I'll talk about the program on the 7th and 9th specifically because it has a historical foundation. It includes a presentation, as we found out just a little while ago, of William Grant Still's 1931 Symphony No. 1, Afro-American, which was premiered by the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra here in Rochester under the baton of Howard Hanson back in 1931. First time an African-American composer was performed in a symphonic work on the stage of a major symphony orchestra. And it's being performed once again later on this month here in Rochester. But there's a new work being premiered. It's from Eastman School of Music Dean Douglas Lowry. It's inspired by the Underground Railroad. It's called The Freedom Zephyr. And its text, included with the music, will be performed by Dr. Paul Burgett, U of R Vice President and music historian. And I want to talk about the genesis of this particular work, starting with, obviously, we're in a place here in Rochester where there's so much history around us. Would it have been impossible not to take note of it, given how much history we're surrounded by?
Well, I think that the phenomenon in this particular case of the Underground Railroad, of course, Rochester was one of many, many places that were instrumental in this movement. It's hard for me when I was presented this idea of composing a work that was inspired at least by the theme of the Underground Railroad to not incorporate Rochester's quite prominent participation and role in that movement. As we know, the Underground Railroad wasn't really a railroad at all. And when I was approached to compose this work, I really wasn't sure. I couldn't think of musical allusions to this until the notion of a narrator came into view. And for me, at least, there are more fundamental themes that underscore the notion of the Underground Railroad, namely the 13th Amendment and the Emancipation Proclamation. And so this work really, in my opinion, is a musical metaphor for this larger, much larger, and frankly more important theme.
Now, we are in the 150th anniversary year of the Emancipation Proclamation and all the deliberations that led up to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments being adapted in 1865, the sesquicentennial of which we're going to celebrate a couple of years from now. But this was, for many people, the end of the line. It was next up onto the boat to Canada.
Absolutely. Yeah, we furnished the gateway.
And as a result, this was a very important place. And let's face it, it was also an important place because of who was here. The reformers, the leaders that were here, Frederick Douglass among them. You know, he's more than a name on a bridge. And I think it's important to realize, I guess, just who he was. There are texts of his remarks, his oratory that are included in this piece that, Dr. Burgett, you're going to read, you're going to voice during the course of this. What particular pieces of Douglass have been selected here? In addition, of course, to the words of others who were noted reformers and literary giants of the mid-19th century.
Well, I think the piece, and I'm going to rely on Doug's notes about this, but most of the writings are from a speech which he gave in Rochester in 1853 under the title Claims of Our Common Cause. There's also a poem of Walt Whitman, and an essay of Ralph Waldo Emerson. But his Claims of Our Common Cause are the centerpiece of the Douglass text.
And these are about really, I guess, trying to make us feel that there's a common cause that we all share, that it isn't just one group or one person's struggle for freedom, it's everybody's.
That's correct. I'd say that's right.
Yeah, the text is really trying to articulate, as I said, a metaphor and bind together a large number of feelings that are all related to ultimately what the Underground Railroad was trying to accomplish. And so the excerpts of text from an essay that Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote called The Spiritualist, and Walt Whitman wrote a series of poems on the Civil War. And I simply drew text out of those sources that bore a relation to this particular subject, and more importantly to the dramatic narrative that unfolds in the piece, both musically and frankly the articulations of the text and the narrator, who implores us to ask some pretty profound questions.
And in the text, for example, in the words of Frederick Douglass came the voice of that very common cause. And now this is Douglass, that governments are to protect. Yes, that governments are to protect. That the Constitution was formed to establish justice, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessing of liberty for all. That resistance to tyrants is obedience to God. That these are principles and maxims that together form the constructive elements of this or any government. It is on this basis that we ground our present and our future. So that's...
Now you can understand why I wanted this guy to do that.
Yes, I do. And there is a contemporary resonance in all of that, because it's actually, in a way, reminding us of some issues that we still have to completely resolve and work out for ourselves.
Yes.
So there is a contemporary relevance to it all.
Oh, yes.
Well, I think that also we continue to have this question. You know, we're being tested, as I wrote in the introduction of the piece in the text, that this was a cause that questioned our disposition to be bonded together. That is to say, what is that commitment? What's the underlying feeling, the desire to be bound together as a common people? And, you know, this is, you know, we're not the only nation on the face of the earth that struggles with this particular theme, but it is particularly pertinent and important at this particular time. And the backdrop that I tried to create was you know, the Civil War and the thousands of lives that were lost in the Civil War, but also that there was a very, very profound cause of freedom and emancipation that was driving this entire movement, and, of course, the Underground Railroad was certainly part of it.
And to pick up on that, and to pick up on your thought about how much work there is to do, to continue with Mr. Douglass's words, which piggyback precisely, Bob, what you said, Douglass says, yet the questions still remain. For how do we grow this shared desire for resolution? And in that glorious place where rests our destiny, also rests our belief in our common resolution. You took the words right out of Frederick Douglass's mouth.
It's hard not to understand Douglass when you're growing up in Rochester, New York.
That's right.
His spirit kind of permeates the area, believe me. And that's a good thing.
It is.
But There's no question about it as well. I'm sure a lot of people will see some very contemporary themes and very contemporary issues playing out here. And to a certain degree, that was in the back of your mind as you were composing.
Well, there's also as was so frequent in the Underground Railroad movement, there was a very, very important link to spirituals. And, you know, it is true. I used a very, very common quote, a very, very common spiritual, "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," in this work. But the words, particularly the phrase in that spiritual, "coming for to carry me home," there are lots of biblical references as well. So when I wrote that it was a zephyr that was gleaming like an electrum, that's a biblical reference, which was bound also into this vision of crossing the River Jordan. And when we cross the River Jordan, this is our place. We're arriving in a place that's home. This is our hope. And these are all vague, but they begin to hopefully congeal into one kind of common thought and feeling that is profound and expresses this collective sense of emancipation and also this collective desire, hopefully, to be bound together.
And the narration ends with the text, and it's really quite beautiful, of resolution. It is a freedom zephyr gleaming like an electrum, as Doug just said, and the last words are, "coming for to carry me home." And so it's a very beautiful conclusion to the piece. And interestingly enough, that spiritual, "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," has an interesting history, because the story has it that that at the River Jordan in the old days, when the king died, he was placed in a canoe with provisions for his transfer to the next life. And as the boat approached the Great Victoria Falls on one occasion, with the members of the tribe on either side of the Jordan singing a song that was similar to that spiritual, angels were seen to descend from the heavens and ferry that canoe with the king into the next life, or into paradise. So there's a wonderful biblical connection to an improved life that I think Doug has captured beautifully in his use of that spiritual, which our audience will hear at the end.
263-WXXI is our number, and we have Sam calling in from the city. Hi, Sam. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
We're doing well, thanks.
I'm glad you took my call, and I just wanted to, I guess I bring it into the 20th century about, you know, our racism and how far we have come and how far we have not come. And just ask a question, I guess, is what do you think the problem is in the Congress now that we can't come together and move forward?
Wow. Is there a political scientist in the house?
Yes, Bob, you are.
Well, I was afraid you would say that. But, that really is almost a question for a political scientist or a historian or some kind of a sociologist who tries to dissect people's motivations, and maybe even a psychologist throwing in as well to figure out why it is that some people are stubborn and resistant to change and other people embrace it.
Well, we grow up in a society in the United States of America that encourages, on the one hand, to stake our claims and stake our claims fervently, and to not give in. And yet, by the same token, we are implored to come together. So, how that gets worked out? Certainly, you ask a question that I'm certainly not capable of answering.
I'd like to thank our caller for his question, because it is a seminal question that we all have to be aware of and thoughtful of, and it is good of you to call and ask that question. We make progress with micro interactions and little steps. The concert that we're talking about today is one of those. Last week, I gave the keynote speech at the Martin Luther King Commission celebration of Dr. King's birthday in Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater. And among my comments was references to an AP, Associated Press poll, which talked about how difficult the dilemma is, and how the very issues that you have thoughtfully brought up in your phone call continue to bedevil us. And I made a reference to what Dr. King would say. Dr. King, above all, would not give up. If nothing else, he endured. And I would refer our caller to a wonderful poem by Langston Hughes called Mother to Son, because I read this poem in Kodak Hall last week at the commission celebration. And it's about endurance, it's about not giving up, it's about continuing the struggle, because we recognize how far we have yet to go. And this poem sort of captures, I think, what you're looking for.
Yeah, I do. Thank you very much, Sam, for posing the question. And really, it's kind of a question that's in a lot of people's minds. Not in the back of their minds, but probably right up front. Do appreciate your calling. 263-WXXI, 263-9994 is our number, so you get involved on 1370 Connection. It is Arts Friday, but this hour, it's about arts that really take on a lot of our history, a lot of our heritage, and a lot of our struggles. We're talking about it all with Dean Douglas Lowery of the Eastman School of Music and U of R Vice President and music historian Dr. Paul Burgett. They're joining together to present the Freedom Zephyr, which is a commemoration of the Underground Railroad and the history that it represented for our community and for our country in its time a century and a half ago. It's part of a program which will also include a presentation of William Grant Still's 1931 Symphony No. 1, which was the first symphony by an African-American composer presented by a major symphony orchestra in America. It was premiered in 1931 right here in Rochester by the RPO under the baton of Howard Hanson, and later recorded in 1939 also by the RPO with Dr. Hanson in charge. And you're going to hear it again, maybe for the first time, on the 7th and on the 9th of this month at Kodak Hall. And that's what we're talking about this hour here on 1370 Connection. But I wonder, Dr. Burgett, when you present those words, when you speak those words that Frederick Douglass wrote and that Emerson and that Whitman wrote, what does it particularly mean to do? What kind of resonance, intellectual and emotional, does it carry for you?
Well, it's not lost on me that as an African American, I have inherited the legacies of this nation's past, and I bear the weight of some of that legacy, but I also bear the fruits of this country's great promise. And so, while I will never forget, I have enjoyed the fruits of this nation's opportunities, and I have experienced its those aspects of its unpleasant past. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which at the time was a very segregated city, and that was quite a long time ago. So I've had the benefit of of creating a kind of balance of opportunity. And as I consider the texts of the poets and writers that Dean Lowry has included, I realize how far we have come and how far we have to go. I take great satisfaction in how far we have come, and I'm reminded of Dr. King's admonition that we have difficult days ahead of us. This is what I said in Kodak Hall last week at the MLK Commission. Dr. King remarked, in fact, on the day before he was assassinated, we have very difficult days ahead of us, and that is in fact the case. But I've been able to metabolize the promise as you hear in the words of the poets and writers that Dean Lowry has included. I've been able to metabolize that with the challenges of the past and move on.
That kind of reminds me in a way as well of other words I heard not so long ago. It reminds me of the speech that the president gave on the night he was elected first in 2008. Same theme in many ways, charting the same things, both the promise and the accomplishment, and also what was ahead and the tough times that were ahead, which I remember him saying, I'm not going to be able to do this in 1 year, maybe not even in one term. Well, it turned out he was right. He was right. He's going to need two. But the thing is, it's almost as if he knew in advance that he was going to need a long time to repair what needed to be repaired and to carry forward what needed to be carried forward. That seems to be a constant theme that's in the public dialogue these days.
It absolutely is. But I think we have to look to the contributions that people make in various domains. I mean, we like to talk about the economy, and that is the issue of poverty is a non-trivial issue, particularly as it affects the African-American community. But there are other places where we make progress. Dean Lowry's piece, for example, the world of the arts and the ways in which the arts are able to uplift people, to lift people beyond the downward pull of a sometimes ugly past and shine the bright light of a positive future. The Eastman School's initiative, and Dean Lowry can talk about this, its initiative in the inner city with children, which is new this year, right, Doug?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So there are ways in which the arts, and as someone who was, I was educated by the Eastman School of Music, I'm an alum, so I belong to Dean Lowry in a certain sense. And so what I see happening in the arts, what I see happening with his composing of the Freedom Zephyr, and the way in which all of us have a part to play, and Dean Lowry is playing a part as a composer to add a piece to our effort at moving this great country forward.
When you take on something like that, tell me a little bit about the process of creating a piece, creating a work of music that gets this across.
Well, every composer approaches this creative process totally differently. But for me, I, in most cases, am most free and fluid when I have a narrative and at work. And so for me to scan, and I scan a lot of texts. I love Ralph Waldo Emerson. A lot that he says, although it's a completely different era, but so much of what he says really taps into the root of the American character. Of course, with Walt Whitman and his poetry, he was extraordinarily moved by the Civil War. But in so much of his poetry, he alluded to this undercurrent of trouble and division, and saw firsthand the ravages of the Civil War, and was so moved about this that he wanted to write constantly about it. So for me, it was really trying to blend that also with what I felt intuitively in my heart to write musically. This was not a piece that I wanted to approach in which I was going to try all sorts of new extended techniques and so forth. I'm at a point in my career, in my life, where simplicity is really the goal, and this work is not about me and my own personal expression. I'm just simply trying to get to the nerve of an issue which I think is dear to us all.
Is this time in American history and American culture right now, given to this kind of reflection, this contemplation about that time and the issues and the ideas of the fields that it brings forward to this one. I mean, you're writing this piece now at the same time that we're going to the movies and we're seeing Steven Spielberg take on some of these same issues with the movie Lincoln that is supposed to be one of the masterpieces of modern filmmaking, and it's about that too. Are we thinking more about our past and its resonance with our present right now than we have in the past?
We might be. I don't know if there's a... I'm not an historian and I'm not a political scientist, so I can't really speak to the issue of the confluence of these things at this particular time. I can say that I think that we should be thinking about them. We should be discussing them, arguing them. We should be grappling not just at a verbal level with what they mean. You know, you have to understand that if this country is going to make real true progress on this issue and any other issue of division, it really comes down to also to individual civic moments in the lives of the real lives, civic lives that we lead, whether it's the corporate world or the educational world. It is the relationship between real human beings and real situations and how you go at those things and still preserve your own character, but are mindful of the commonality, not the divisions, but the commonality.
And I am told that Ford Hall in Ithaca is the venue where it's going to be performed. In between,
thank you for
letting somebody knows what's going on.
In between the two performances at Kodak Hall here in Rochester at the Eastman Theater campus and complex. And I wish we had even more time to talk about this, but we have time only to say thank you to our guests of the hour. Our thanks to Maestro Ward Stair, who shared the first half of the hour with us, and our thanks to our guests through the entire hour. Eastman School of Music Dean Douglas Lowry, who has created the new work, The Freedom Zephyr, which will be performed, and Dr. Paul Burgett, Vice President of the University of Rochester, who will provide the narration of The Freedom Zephyr during the performances of the 7th and 9th at Kodak Hall. And our thanks to all of you for listening in on this hour of the Arts Friday edition of 1370 Connection at WXXI AM and FM Rochester. For our technical director, John Andrus, I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure.